This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Tuesday, with so many of us now working out of the office, could we be seeing the end of the 9-to-5 workday with the 24/7 work from home day, its replacement?
I think this is creating a dangerous situation where workers feel they have to bend over backward, answer emails at any time of the day or night, ensure that they're always on the job in order to keep their employer pleased with them.
And Canberra-Beijing relations are strained because of Australia's push for an inquiry into the coronavirus. We'll discuss what a probe might find. But we'll take to the skies first up today, and as the premiers of various states debate the merits of opening up state borders, Qantas has announced plans to increase domestic flights. Now, it's also detailed measures designed to reduce the risk of catching the virus, describing them as new norms. Passengers will be seated side by side, but they'll be offered masks and alcohol wipes, and there'll be a reduction in the onboard service. Our reporter Annie Guest joined Qantas's media conference by telephone this morning. She joins us now with more. Afternoon, Annie. So firstly, how can Qantas talk about ramping up interstate flights when we're hearing that some borders could be closed until at least July?
Well, that's right, Tom. There's been concern about border closures and positions taken by states, particularly Queensland, where the chief medical officer here is saying that she recommends the border is not reopened before July. The premier has said September. There's been lots of pressure from the tourism industry and also from the New South Wales government. And now the Qantas CEO has indicated that he's aware there may be a change. And here's what Alan Joyce had to say on the issue of closed interstate borders.
We're even hearing today, I think, that the Queensland Premier is just clarifying the position. And she says, hopefully, that this will be as early as July. I think you can see from some of the commentary in the last 24 hours that the tourism industry is calling out for those borders to open. And if the premiers were to make that decision, and we're getting ready for that.
Qantas CEO Alan Joyce. So, Annie, what's the airline saying about the risks of catching COVID-19 on its aircraft?
Well, Tom, they're saying that there's not going to be social distancing on the aircraft. They say the risk is low due to pre-existing factors like the air filters on planes and the forward-facing seats, and then the additional measures, which we'll go into further later. But it has what it's saying has actually been contested by flight attendants, Tom, who do think the risk is high, and they're talking about a class action. The airline says it's participating in some research with health authorities to investigate risks further, but it says it believes it's very low. Here's Qantas's medical director, Dr. Ian Hosegood.
As far as physical distancing on board the aeroplane, we know that's an issue that's been discussed and obviously has received a lot of attention. We don't believe physical distancing in flight is necessary, but also clearly it's not practical. If we were to implement the full physical distancing rules, we would have only a handful of people on any aircraft.
Dr. Ian Hosegood, Qantas's medical director. Annie Guest is with me. So, Annie, you mentioned these measures the airline's putting in place. It says it'll help to further reduce that risk. What do we know?
Tom, I'll run through them. It includes asking people to abide by the public health advice, to stay home if unwell, encouraging contactless check-ins via online services and apps, the bag drop-off, hand sanitising stations at departure gates and in the Qantas lounge where some service will be reduced. Passengers will be given face masks and alcohol wipes, masks not compulsory but recommended, alcohol wipes to clean down the area where they're sitting, simplified service and catering, limited movement around the cabin, sequenced boarding and disembarkation, and airline employees required to follow strict personal hygiene measures. And for more on that, here's the Qantas CEO, Alan Joyce, again.
We're providing masks and sanitising wipes and hand sanitisers to all customers. And we will be limiting movement in flight. Masks will not be mandatory from a safety point of view, but they will be recommended to be worn in the interest of everybody's peace of mind.
Qantas CEO Alan Joyce again. There, any guest reporting. Well, at least he's practicing what he preaches. The US President Donald Trump has revealed he's taking the anti-malarial drug, hydroxychloroquine. He's been praising the drug since the early days of the pandemic, despite there being little clinical evidence. And his admission has prompted medical experts around the world to caution against its use to prevent or treat COVID-19. Rachel Mealy has the latest.
President Trump was speaking to reporters at the White House about something they thought they'd heard before, when an answer to a question took a surprising twist.
And a lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. And you'd be surprised at how many people are taking it, especially the frontline workers, before you catch it. The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
When?
Right now, yeah.
Yeah, when?
A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it.
The US Food and Drug Administration warned last month that hydroxychloroquine was unproven as a treatment or a prevention for COVID-19 and warned that it can cause abnormalities in heart rhythm for people with the virus. The president says he's been taking the drug for the past 10 days.
So I have been taking it for about a week and a half.
Every day?
At some point, every day. I take a pill every day. At some point, I'll stop. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have the cure and or the vaccine, and that'll happen, I think, very soon.
The president's decision to take the drug may have been triggered when two White House staff members tested positive for the virus in early May. He says his White House doctor prescribed the drug.
I would have told you that 3-4 days ago, but we never had a chance because you never asked me the question.
Did the White House doctor recommend that you take that? Is that why you're taking it?
Yeah, White House doctor. Didn't recommend. No, I asked him, what do you think? He said, well, if you'd like it. I said, yeah, I'd like it. I'd like to take it. A lot of people are taking it. A lot of frontline workers are taking hydroxychloroquine. A lot of front. I don't take it because, hey, people said, oh, maybe he owns the company. No, I don't know the company. You know what? I want the people of this nation to feel good. I don't want them being sick.
Doctors and medical experts expressed alarm at the president's announcement. Even on the conservative Fox News channel, anchor Neil Cavuto issued this warning.
If you are in a risky population here and you are taking this as a preventative treatment to ward off the virus, or in a worst case scenario, you are dealing with the virus, and you are in this vulnerable population, it will kill you. I cannot stress enough. This will kill you. So again, whatever benefits the president says this has, and certainly it has had for those suffering from malaria, dealing with lupus, this is a leap that should not be taken casually by those watching at home or assuming, well, the president of the United States says it's okay.
In Australia, businessman Clive Palmer has also been touting the drug's use. His foundation bought almost 33 million doses as a donation towards Australia's fight against COVID-19. Dr. Paul Griffin is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Queensland. He says the evidence on hydroxychloroquine just doesn't stack up.
That was a drug that showed some promise initially, but when reviewed in larger studies, the evidence would suggest it's probably not effective and does carry with it some significant side effects. So while it's still in use in some clinical trials so we can gain more evidence to see whether it works or not, at this stage we'd certainly recommend not using it outside of a clinical trial situation.
Associate Professor Paul Griffin from the University of Queensland. That report from Rachel Mealy. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. Don't talk about the war, seems to be the approach from the government today after China followed through on threats to impose trade sanctions on barley farmers. Now, both the agriculture and trade ministers say an 80% import tariff isn't linked to Australia's successful call for an independent investigation into the origins of the coronavirus. But either way, the race is now on to find other markets for that barley crop, which has just gone into paddocks. Here's our political reporter, Tom Eagledon.
About half of Australia's barley crop's been going to China since a free trade deal in 2014, mostly for brewing beer or feeding animals. The 80% tariff China imposed overnight brings that to a halt. Farmers Federation President Tony Ma.
It is
particularly devastating after the time that Australian farmers have had in the last number of years with droughts, floods and fires. And finally, we get, by and large, really good conditions for a great crop this year. And talking to farmers last night when this broke about 11 o'clock, you know, some farmers I spoke to were finishing off their last planting of barley, last paddock of barley, and now we wake up this morning and we're going to see this tariff of 80% applied. So a significant and devastating hit to the Australian agriculture industry.
Now, new export markets will need to be found for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of the grain. Agriculture Minister David Littleproud will meet with barley growers tomorrow.
We have already, only in the last week, opened up greater access into India in getting some of their conditions eased to allow easier access into India. We now have a free trade agreement that starts on the 5th of July with Indonesia and also within the Middle East. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are also interested.
The Chinese tariffs will be in place for 5 years. Australia's likely to appeal to the World Trade Organization, which officiates trade disputes, but that's a slow-moving process, leaving Australia with little short-term option other than to complain via unofficial channels.
The premise of their argument, saying that we have subsidised farmers through farm household allowance, which is a social security payment, and through programs through the Murray-Darling Basin, are false. The reality is most of Australian barley isn't produced in the Murray-Darling Basin or under irrigated purposes.
Despite that, he insists the trading relationship remains strong.
No, there's no trade war. And in fact, even today, I think you've seen that there's increased demand for iron ore out of China.
And that there's no link with Australia's call for an independent investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 outbreak.
And we will now be doubling down on our efforts to pursue this investigation by experts even quicker.
That's likely to further raise China's anger levels. Overnight, Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed to an investigation, but only at the right time, interpreted by most to mean deep into the future. Former Liberal Foreign Minister Alexander Downer told RN Breakfast belligerence from Australia's biggest trading partner is a difficult issue at the best of times.
China is very difficult to deal with, and my whole experience of China is they will attempt to bully you as hard as they can. They use extravagant language, as the ambassador here has been doing. They threaten all kinds of trade retaliation and the like to try to force you to do what they want.
And he says, trade war or not, backing down is not an option.
If you send a message to China that every time you get cross with us, you know, you make us tremble and we'll always obey, well, then they'll keep doing it. If you make the perfectly clear to China that you'll never succeed with Australia that way, well, eventually they will move towards a more constructive phase in their diplomacy.
Former Liberal Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, that report from Tom Eagledon in Canberra. Well, speaking of extravagant language, a short time ago we received a statement from China's embassy here saying it's a joke for Australia to claim it's been vindicated by international support for an inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. This has come as the World Health Assembly gets underway in Geneva, where Chinese President Xi Jinping has defended China's handling of the outbreak. Then there's that question of a comprehensive review. And as we just heard from Tom, China says it will support one after the virus is brought under control. To discuss the World Health Assembly and the possible outcomes, I spoke to Professor Sarah Davies, who's an expert in global health governance from Griffith University.
I think this is no doubt more important than the SARS outbreak and the World Health Assembly that followed that one, because we are dealing with an outbreak of far greater magnitude. This one is testing multiple countries. It's testing them not just their health systems, it's testing them economically. In some cases, it's testing their very political and social security.
So a lot at stake. What could the outcomes be for the future of the World Health Organization, for example? And by that I mean, is this a turning point in a way for the WHO towards having more power or perhaps less power?
It's difficult to say, in the sense that there's definitely been a majority consensus that the World Health Organization needs to be supported to do the work that it's doing. So there may be a slight increased sentiment towards giving it more power, but I would say more than anything at the moment, what I'm reading is it needs to be supported to keep doing what it's doing.
And obviously the role of China is crucial here. China's promised billions of dollars towards the fight against COVID-19, but we're also hearing about this resistance towards an international inquiry into the origins of the virus. In your view, what role is China trying to play in global health?
There's no doubt that China sees the United States' expressions of discontent with the World Health Organization as a chance for China to assert itself here. China has been seeking to adopt quite a strong role in health diplomacy for a number of years now.
And we saw Australia and the United States shut down travel from China when this outbreak first emerged. Could this assembly change the advice around trade and travel in response to global health emergencies?
This is what's been really interesting about the World Health Assembly up to this point, is that we've had actually at the same time the release of the first independent commission that was set up after the Ebola outbreak. And what we've seen in this first report is discussion about the need to try and understand in a better way what is the responsibility of the World Health Organization in making recommendations around trade and travel, because it is clear in this outbreak that states have taken these matters into their own hands. And we've had a vast number of states adopting all kinds of very different, uncoordinated trade and travel restrictions. And some of them appear to be based on public health advice and scientific advice, but some of them don't. They seem to be political.
Yeah, and I guess I need to ask, because it's on a lot of our minds, this issue of a vaccine. What about that? Do you think this assembly will decide that question of what happens if and when a vaccine is developed?
So it's very important to see again that the European Union, a number of states in South America, as well as Sub-Saharan Africa, and of course in our own region, including Australia, have been very vocal in supporting the need for some sort of cooperative arrangement around vaccine production and supply. And there is very much a sentiment that there should not be a desire to try and exercise, you know, sovereign control over a vaccine if it is developed. But of course, the devil is always in the details, because what we've got to look is, while there's lots of states expressing sentiments of support, it will be very important to look at the states that maybe aren't giving full voice support. And of course, what will be very important going forward is looking at the details and the commitment, and of course the realisation of these details should a vaccine be discovered.
Professor Sarah Davies there from Griffith University. Well, working in an office, it comes with its own problems, of course, but with many employees at home, there are new challenges. We're hearing that the work from home revolution has led to an epidemic of loneliness and to the collapse of the working day as we know it. So we might not be working 9 to 5, but the worry for many is they're now working 24/7. Gavin Coote's been taking a look.
Kate's work from home routine might sound like a pretty familiar one.
So in the morning, checking some emails, things like that, pretty normal.
But for the Sydney occupational therapist, her patient interaction is now through her laptop.
Sometimes I'll do some worksite visits, having a look at the injured workers that I'm working with and seeing what kind of sites that they're working on. So we'll do that via Zoom or some sort of video method, just so I can make sure that their ergonomic setup is good, and to see if there's any changes we need to make to the workplace.
She now no longer needs to drive across the suburbs of Sydney or around regional New South Wales to visit her clients. But Kate's working hours are still blowing out at the other end of the day, with endless emails and paperwork demanding her attention.
I find that I maybe work through lunch a little bit more and get more done and stay a little bit later, because there's no time to leave the office, where before it was kind of 4 o'clock and you would just leave it all behind, but now you can kind of blend into up to, say, 6 o'clock and not be able to log off then because there's no one telling you to stop.
It's an emerging issue out of the isolation period. The Australian Bureau of Statistics has found nearly half of the country's workforce made the shift and began working from home in the past month. Darryl Cross is both working from his Adelaide home and helping others who are doing the same. He's an organisational psychologist and executive coach who, like many, is spending big chunks of his day on video calls.
But it's just different. I know what I have to do. I know when I have to do it by, and I fit in other things around that. I might pop out to the shops for something, but it is a much more relaxed style, and I think much more enjoyable.
Some big employers like Twitter have found it so successful, they've declared staff will be able to keep working from home long after the pandemic passes. But it's not all rosy. The ABS has revealed this week that loneliness was the most common source of stress in April. The survey also found 1 in 5 people were finding it tricky to maintain a healthy lifestyle, with the temptation of junk food, alcohol and television all the more accessible. Economist Jim Stanford from the Centre for Future Work also thinks the problem of unpaid overtime work is growing.
Working from home is going to help families and the economy get through the lockdown, but it isn't a magic bullet.
And with the job market becoming all the more competitive, Jim Stanford worries workers will be even more willing to put in long hours from home.
Workers feel a lot of pressure to go out of their way to satisfy their employer, to show that they'll go the extra mile in hopes that they'll be able to keep their job or get their contract renewed. And I think this is creating a dangerous situation where workers feel they have to bend over backwards, answer emails at any time of the day or night, ensure that they're always on the job in order to keep their employer pleased with them.
For all its challenges, Sydney occupational therapist Kate thinks the new way of working isn't all bad.
I think working from home in the future would be good to have as an ongoing alternative in terms of workers staying happy and enjoying their jobs more, I think. So I think employers should definitely take that on board.
Occupational therapist Kate and Gavin Coote with that report. Well, our business reporter David Taylor has been writing about this dilemma. You can find his piece on the ABC News website, and he joined me earlier. David, this idea of work following us around isn't exactly new, but what's changed in the past few weeks that's brought the problem to the fore again?
Tom, I guess what's changed is so many people have gone from working in the office or somewhere remotely to working in their home. And to be honest with you, certainly around town even, people have said to me, friends, relatives, whatever, so what are your hours? Because people are looking for conversation starters. And inevitably, I have to sort of think to myself, well, what are my hours? And the conversation flows from there. And over again, I've been hearing people say, well, I guess I don't have hours anymore, because I check my email at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm looking at social media during the day. I can get a call from my boss at 9 o'clock at night asking me to just quickly go to the laptop and do this extra thing for me. And why is he asking me to do that? Or why is she asking me to do that? Well, simply because it's there. And people are starting to really notice that the day has gone from 8 till 6 or 9 till 5 or whatever it might be to not having boundaries at all. And that's what's caught the attention of researchers. Now, the latest report from the Centre for Future Work, looking at excessive hours and unpaid overtime, which is what it ends up being, on average, we're now completing an extra 4 to 5 hours of work for free every week. So that's roughly an extra hour a day. And that won't be surprising for people who are noticing that they're clocking off a lot later than usual. But yesterday, earlier this week, we had research from the Australian Bureau of Statistics noting that 13% of all workers are putting in more hours than usual right now. So the report from the Centre for Future Work was late last year, and this survey from the ABS is literally over the past 4 weeks. So the problem has begun with the advent and the real explosion of mobile devices and immediate access to work, and is reaching a bit of a climax at the moment with people working from home and not having an excuse to say no to the boss. And the ABS is picking it up, and it's just quite rife at the moment that people are working so many hours and not getting paid for some of that, Tom.
Yeah, so what are the mental and physical flow-on effects of all of this? And do you think that could have the potential to, you know, derail the economic recovery out of this COVID-19 recession?
Now, Tom, I guess it all depends on how you respond to it. There seems to be a connection between feeling pressured to do work, not being paid for it, and feeling a sense of building anxiety. And the anxiety comes from losing control. So during the Industrial Revolution, for instance, work days were defined, and post the Industrial Revolution, it got worse and worse, but has since pulled back. And post World War II, for instance, Australia was able to secure Saturday as being a day off. But since then, well, I guess since mobile devices have picked up, it's gone backwards the other way. And that's coincided with increased levels of anxiety. And psychologists say there's a direct link there, that the more you feel pressured to do work, the more you feel like you can't say no, the higher the anxiety becomes. And of course, the more you feel like you're losing control of your work day. So all of that leads to the potential for an economic derailment because, well, productivity is already flat. And the fear is that productivity will get worse as people lose the ability to relax, to disconnect from work, and then that will refresh them, and then they can get back into work enthusiastic and ready to go. At the moment, we're seeing burnout. We're not seeing that enthusiasm to get stuck back into it. And that, Tom, is what economists are worried about.
Joining me there from home, business reporter David Taylor. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. I'm Thomas Ariti. Stay safe and have a lovely afternoon. Chat tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Great Barrier Reef has been experiencing its most widespread coral bleaching event on record. But could a species of obscure coral that seems to be thriving despite warmer water help?
Today on The Signal, we look at the science of coral bleaching and ask whether there's still time to save the reef from destruction. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.